Magnesium plays a critical role in vital bodily functions, including energy production, heart health, immunity, and more restful sleep. Magnesium is ubiquitous in metabolic pathways that affect virtually all organ systems. So I'm excited to tell you about MagSRT from Jigsaw Health. MagSRT has rightfully earned a reputation as the most popular, most bioavailable, and best-tolerated magnesium brands in the world. The developers of MagSRT have solved a problem that deters many from getting adequate intake of elemental magnesium. Their unique formulation is gentle on the stomach and doesn't produce unwanted GI effects. Jigsaw Health also offers MagSoothe, a great-tasting, fast-acting, calming magnesium glycinate powder that helps relax your legs, muscles, and brain for better sleep. Jigsaw MagSoothe helps you fall asleep faster, sleep better, and reduces leg cramps. For more information and to order MagSRT and MagSoothe, just go to jigsawhealth.com. That's jigsawhealth.com. Use coupon code HOFFMAN10 for $10 off your order. That's jigsawhealth.com and use code HOFFMAN10 for MagSRT and MagSoothe. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, a discussion that I'm very much looking forward to because we're going to tackle a crucial issue, freedom of choice in healthcare. And specifically, our theme today is the current campaign by the Alliance for Natural Health, Free Speech for Health. So let me tell you a little bit about the Alliance for Natural Health. The ANH stands as a guardian of your right to choose natural, sustainable healthcare options. And I became a board member of ANH because I feel it's very consonant with my personal mission, which is to get out important health information, both to patients one-on-one, but also to the public. ANH is the guardian of our access to natural healthcare, to natural health products, to a safe and clean environment. And I can think of no person better qualified to talk to us about the subject today than our guest, my good friend and colleague, Rob Frakirk. Rob, I downloaded your CV, or I attempted to download it, but then I said, I don't want to jam up my printer because it is too long and lugubrious. So I'm just going to hit some of the top lines. To me, Rob is just a great guy to have a discussion with over a dark beer and to recount exploits about our cycling, of which he is very, very clearly surpasses me because he's up and down the hills of his native England on those kind of scary two-lane roads where they drive on the left. He is outstanding in that regard. But he's also, in 2002, the founder of the Alliance for Natural Health International, ANH International, which is UK-based but covers the entire world. With the exception of the US, we have our own organization, which is ANH-USA.org. Recently, Rob became executive director of ANH USA. Is that even legal, Rob? You know, you're a UK citizen and you run an organization.
Absolutely. Totally legal. Ron, okay. Would I ever do anything illegal?
No, indeed.
No, absolutely. You can be a director of a 501c3, 501c4, no problems.
Okay.
But I do not hold, and I'm backwards and forwards far too often.
Okay, yes, indeed.
I should just fix myself in the States.
Yes, you deserve your own private plane, but I know you want to keep your carbon footprint low. So Rob has, numerous degrees. He's the author of over 60 articles in the fields of natural medicine, but also in relationship to the environment. Lately, his cause celeb is a freedom of choice in terms of our access to reliable, truthful healthcare information. And this is not just, by the way, Rob, you're situating yourself within a bigger controversy because we're talking about our realm, which is natural health and the environment. And there's so much that's happening in regard to these campaigns about misinformation and disinformation. These have become buzzwords There are organizations like the World Health Organization and universities and the media and social media that have set themselves up as arbiters of the truth. And so why is it that you feel this campaign is so important?
Well, let me give you a quote from, and by the way, Ron, just great to be on Intelligent Medicine podcast again. But Elon Musk famously tweeted not so long ago that free speech is the bedrock of a functioning democracy. And he said, without it, America ends. If you take that general view, and of course, it is a view that not everyone subscribes to, as we move into an ever more authoritarian kind of shift transition in governments around the world. Only 8% of the world's population, according to the Economist Democracy Index, currently live in true functioning democracies, we're told. But, you know, free speech is not only the bedrock of democracy, it's also the bedrock of good self-care. And, you know, if we don't have freedom of expression for the people, people can't make informed decisions and they can't exercise one of the most fundamentally important principles of medical ethics, which is informed consent. So if you choose to, if you like, distort and limit and moderate the information that people get, and you particularly favor certain types of information, such as information about pharmaceutical medicines or vaccines, and then you limit information about natural health, the public doesn't get a fair shot at the available information. Of course, what really got our attention was the change in the YouTube medical misinformation policy on the 15th of August last year. And what we suddenly started to see is a big change in how content was being moderated. And it was a, you know, essentially what the policy says is, guys, if you want to post videos on the biggest video platform in the world, you have to make sure that your content basically complies with either what are termed local authorities, read that as national authorities, in other words, national institutes of health, CDC, et cetera, in the United States, equivalents in other parts of the world, or, and the or is really important here, or the World Health Organization. As we move towards this big decision at the end of this month, where the 77th World Health Assembly will determine whether sovereignty in terms of health-making decisions, particularly during pandemics that can be declared unilaterally by the World Health Organization, you know, if that sovereignty has been ceded to the WHO. So essentially what happened on the 15th of August last year is that they started to really change the way in which different users started to see content. And of course, we were contacted by some of the leading doctors in the field of keto diets and intermittent fasting to say, hey, you know, we've gone from, you know, hundreds of thousands of views per day. These are people who've got over 10 million subscriber base. So the data becomes really pretty clear to see, because you see this sort of massive drop in numbers from hundreds of thousands of views per day to only a few hundred. So it's not the deplatforming that we were seeing during the COVID era. I mean, loads of people just lost their platforms. It was a binary censorship system. And of course, we were very alive to what might happen because they told us all about it in May 2023 at the Nobel Prize Summit that was held in Washington, D.C., that we followed during the 3 or 4 days of it. We followed every part of it, and we wrote extensively about what was going on. And essentially what they said, look, we need to now initiate a war on disinformation because, you know, the world is, you know, the airwaves are alive with all these conspiracy theories, and people are getting very confused and they're going to be hurt as a result of it. And we're going to be working together with leading universities and the big tech companies in order to stop it happening. And the way that the system we will be using is going to be AI based. And that in itself was pretty interesting because, you know, if you look at what even the World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab have said about AI, it is, on one hand, it could be one of the biggest assets in certain areas, but it also could be one of the biggest threats. So, you know, any new technology always comes with pluses and minuses. So we now have entered this post-COVID era with no real public discussion of what's going on. We all recognize that social media is the new, you know, digital town square. But where on earth is the public discussion on this? And, you know, how are we going to navigate it? You know, our only interest in A&H is to make sure that people do receive balanced, honest, truthful information about natural health. But we know for sure that the WHO and, you know, most of the institutes within NIH and the National Academies of Sciences, they are not able to be expert across the board on all these issues. And also, most of these issues are not just black and white issues where, you know, we know the answer that's relevant to every single person on the planet. We're all individual. There is a huge amount of uncertainty involved in most medical interventions, including the use of pharmaceuticals. And, you know, discourse itself has been a really, really vital part of the scientific process.
Moving the science forward, traditionally,
exactly.
Right?
You know, we have this idea of promoting a hypothesis, getting it out there, experimenting it, having detailed enough methodology so that others can repeat the experiment. And, you know, eventually over a period of time, through discourse, it is the stuff that really sticks, the stuff that can withstand dissent, that becomes, you know, what we call, you know, solid intelligence. It's no longer this fluid intelligence that is kind of moving around as the science. And that becomes the knowledge base, the thing that people like to call truth. I personally, I'm kind of surprised that Nobel Prize Committee are using the term truth around science because, mm-hmm. you know, it's
almost
very
ironic or it's almost an oxymoron.
It is.
To talk about, quote, scientific truth because science is in flux, continually developing. Exactly. Hypotheses are developed, critiqued, some stand, some fall, some are revised, and that's the basis of scientific progress throughout the ages. I mean, we have, you know, what was interesting to me is that I was just in Europe, and there was an argument that was brought up that we're, in regard to scientific consensus, we're actually moving backwards. We're moving backwards to the days of Copernicus and Galileo. Remember when they proposed that the Earth revolved around the sun based on their mathematical calculations, that this was contrary to the teachings of the church. And we actually had science that was at the behest of the church. It was at the behest of an ideology. And to have objective science, which is, look, our mathematical calculations, sorry, guys, shows that the sun really does revolve, that the Earth does really revolve around the sun. It went against religious dogma, and the result is that the scientists were persecuted, incarcerated, and sometimes burned at the stake, literally.
100%. Yeah, heliocentrism. I mean, what a wild idea. And, you know, we live in a world in which now there are a group of universities that have become extremely well-funded who are playing a particular tune that seems to me to be deviating ever more from this kind of notion of objective science. It is nearly all corporate funded, or it's funded by, you know, Gates. My old university, Imperial College London, is the biggest single funder is you know, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
True.
So, you know, we're seeing this complete change in the academic environment. And, you know, as we have kind of heard that number of academic institutions are going to be involved. Johns Hopkins obviously is well known for its work on the coronavirus project. But Cambridge University is pretty involved in the UK. And there is one particular department, the Cambridge Social Decision Making Lab, headed by a professor, Sander van der Linden, who I've had the good fortune of listening to live in a debate 3 weeks or so ago. I've just written a piece about it. And I'm really disturbed by the lack of objectivity and the bias that creeps into their view. You know, essentially, what we learned in the talk, you know, I've also read most of his papers in this subject. He is one of the key academics that's developing the tools that can be used in the war on misinformation. It's what the World Health Organization called an infodemic. So we move from a pandemic.
Let's double click on that subject because you just wrote an article that appeared in Substack. It's also available via ANH-USA.org and ANH International, which is a fascinating article because there is a current campaign to, quote, immunize people against misinformation or disinformation. And what they say basically is, if we protest that this information is bogus, that it only makes conspiracy theorists more vociferous in their support of these theories. So what we need to do is we need to, quote, inoculate people against misinformation. And they've created a series of clever games or simulations which enable people to learn how to debunk conspiracy theories. And it's really quite a clever campaign, but it's rather insidious. Can you take us down the dark rabbit hole on those?
Exactly. It's actually to not just debunk, but it's to pre-bunk.
So you pre-bunk.
So Sander van der Linden and his team were very much involved in the development of this concept. Now, guess where they got the ideas from? This bit.
I would say George Orwell, 1984.
I think he must have read some of that. But how about IS? How about extremist terrorist organization?
Oh, interesting.
So I was really shocked, to be honest, that is where they looked. They looked at the techniques that are used by extremist terrorist organizations to radicalize their public. And then they've applied those. And what they do is that they expose them to the opposite kind of information. So you can imagine that, you know, people like Biden and Trump and, you know, leaders in the West would all feature in those so that they can start to develop a hatred for those people. In essence, what they do is expose you to small amounts of the misinformation.
Homeopathic misinformation.
Yeah. So essentially they've got two major games because they've also done the research that shows that it is the youngsters, people who are most susceptible to this kind of misinformation. And it is strange. I think even that is slightly odd in terms of my anecdotal observation of people I know who have partaken in rallies that have protested against the mainstream narrative during the COVID era. What I saw was not a huge number of young people there and quite a lot of older people, perhaps slightly wiser people or people who are prepared to take a risk in relation to their careers, because they, you know, if you look at it, also the medical doctors that have stood up and said, hey, we need to do early treatments. We need to use hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and quercetin and vitamin D and vitamin C and all the rest of it. These tended to be older doctors.
Let me submit a slightly different interpretation. Is our generation, the baby boomer generation, I'm speaking of myself, perhaps not you because you span the generations. We were a generation that was thoroughly disenchanted with the status quo. We grew up in the 1960s in the wake of the assassination of President Kennedy, in the wake of the war against drugs, in the wake of the Vietnam War, which were incredibly challenging and decredibilizing to the popular narrative. And so we learned to challenge authority, many of us. We kind of were reared in an environment where the authority actually had very paltry credibility, ultimately. And so applying that same attitude towards edicts, say, from the World Health Organization, the CDC, experts, health gurus who tell us that keto diets will kill you and low-carb diets are long-term harmful, we're very ready to challenge that narrative and say, show me.
Well, I think you've hit it bang on the head. I mean, that would immediately, I mean, your observation is the same as my observation. I don't have the data. I think we should question the notion that young people are most swayed by misinformation and therefore all the techniques should be geared towards young people. So if you develop, for example, a game that is an online game. I mean, I've played it myself. I've done all the misinformation test. And the peculiar thing is that what they do in their games, the two main games, one is called Bad News and the other one's called Go Viral. Go Viral is completely supported by the UK Cabinet Office, by the World Health Organization.
And funded, because this is a considerable undertaking, right?
Oh, it's a massive undertaking. I've also played it last weekend with my 19-year-old daughter, who said it actually made her feel physically sick because of it was so denigrating.
Yeah.
The doctors, the scientists, you know, including her own father, who have spent 4 years of our lives standing up against this. They have such a low perspective. We could hear with Van der Linden during the talk that he would be saying very regularly, you know, the problem with these conspiracy theorists and a conspiracy theorist in their definition is anyone who has a view that is not consistent with fact checkers like PolitiFact,
right?
Run by the
snake oil salesman.
What's next?
You know, you don't seem that wild eyed. You know, you're not wearing striped pants. You're not barking your recommendations from the back of a traveling wagon in the village square selling snake oil potion to the unsuspecting inhabitants of the village.
You see, but Ron, that's what they think.
Yeah,
that's the kind of mindset that they are entertaining, where they're getting these young people to start to develop literally a hatred for these conspiracy theories, because they're calling themselves experts. There was no, even in the initial evaluation profile where you give your name, nothing about what your background might be, that you might be a scientist or a doctor and you might know a thing or two about these issues. Essentially, what they're saying is that do not consider being an expert. One of the learnings is that you must never try and be an expert. Leave it up to the people who know most, which is the government and, you know, dare I say it, the fact checkers. The fact checkers are really held there as the arbiters. And, you know, there is no peer review system going on amongst the fact checkers. There's often a real distortion of information that, you know, if you look at, say, information around the origin of the virus, you know, they will take a tiny element of it and say, you know, there is no, you know, proof that it was a lab leak. But there's no mention of the Department of Energy report, the fact that you got two major U.S. governments, you know, departments saying that, guys, it's highly likely. But of course, they use the concept of proof, and of course, proving it is pretty difficult.
Right,
that's categoric proof.
It's hard to prove a negative. But yeah. So, what are some of the lessons of COVID that have sort of highlighted this issue? Because I cannot think of a moral panic more severe than happened during COVID. I mean, we were scared, we were uncertain, but the backlash against any intimation that, say, vitamin D or vitamin C might be helpful in COVID, or that perhaps masks weren't what they were cracked up to be, or perhaps there was a lab leak from Wuhan lab, or perhaps it didn't quite make sense for us to stand 2 meters or 6 feet away because they put stuff on the sidewalk. So if you're waiting to get into a store, you had to stand on your mark. That these might not have had, or the plexiglass, all the plexiglass that they installed, or the visors that people were putting over their faces. All these things that ultimately did not stand the test of time, much less the vaccine campaign, which was said, you know, to stop the spread. Didn't really stop the spread. Possibly mitigated some of the severity of symptoms in the beginning, unclear. No side effects. Well, that didn't pan out very well. All these issues kind of highlight the fact that, quote, conspiracy theories were actually reasonable challenges to the party line.
That is the problem with the use of language and semantics, is that what has now become misinformation is information that may well be plausible or valid based on available information, but it is purely information that challenges the you know, the predetermined doctrine that the mainstream, you know, narrative is using. So, you know, this is, you know, if we look at the restrictions, the behavioral restrictions that we faced during the pandemic, you know, from masks to lockdowns, et cetera, we're now seeing a restriction that's occurring at a different level. It's a restriction about what we can speak about, you know, and this becomes really important in the United States, because, you know, going back to your history, you know, what the founding fathers did was understand that there was a need to rein in governments, because governments could impose, the British government could impose these massive limitations on your freedoms. And that's why there are so many freedoms that are protected within the US Constitution. The challenge we have now is that the governments have, if you like, hived off that responsibility for controlling free speech to the mainstream media and the big tech platforms, mm-hmm. when these are now right. our digital town squares. So, you know, we may say, well, hell, you know, every platform, every private corporation should have autonomy. And, but we need to rethink this when, you know, and of course, you know, Murthy versus Missouri, the case that's going through the Supreme Court at the moment, is absolutely critical in this. And
that, you know, that's the one about collusion between the government and the social yeah. media, and yeah. how it, in effect, there were government, directives and coordination. Could you please suppress this information?
Correct.
And they just went along to get along. They said, well, look, you know, we don't want to get our nose out of joint with the government. The government requires us to do this. So let's just throttle down on some of this information.
There are only seven parties that took that challenge, but they're quite important seven parties. Two of them are states. One is Missouri, the other is Louisiana, two whole states. And then the five human beings that are involved include two that were involved in the Great Barrington Declaration, which, you know, mm-hmm. collected nearly a million signatures and basically provided a scientific public health case mm-hmm. for, if you like, a light lockdown approach, probably akin to the approach that Sweden used.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Swedish paradigm, which they were vindicated for ultimately. I mean, initially they had a few higher cases, a little higher mortality, but ultimately the flattening the curve actually caused more havoc than, you know, an initial bump followed by some degree of herd immunity and less economic devastation and social devastation to the society.
Absolutely. So, you know, in essence, what we're going to see is how the Supreme Court judges will rule on that. You know, as I said in another article I've written about the case, I read the whole case and read the evidence. It is fascinating. And, you know, I've been party to thinking about this idea of collusion and coercion that's been widely used in discussion around the case. Having read it, I have to read the evidence, you know, the foundation stones of the whole case, and seen the email correspondence and slash correspondence, you know, that was occurring between officials within the Biden administration and the big social companies, mm-hmm. including Facebook and, you know, Google, Alphabet, etc. I mean, it is a whole lot more coercion than collusion. I mean, It is, these tech companies were being told, I mean, here I am defending the tech companies. I didn't think I'd be doing that. But the tech companies were told, if you do not remove that, you know, Robert Kennedy Jr. post by the end of today, we're going to hold you responsible for X, Y, and Z. So, you know, they were put under massive pressure. The bottom line is judges are as susceptible as the rest of us to this drip feed of, you know, compliance or resistance. As you said, you know, some of us have no problems in resisting it. I've been doing some work with the World Freedom Alliance and talking with some colleagues in Greece. You know, the two who are leading the campaign in Greece, when we were chatting about it, we were when I said, look, my mother's family were, you know, raised in Greece. They were part of a Dutch group that had been thrown out of Turkey, and they sailed out to Greece, and that's where my mother was born. But all of my family were involved in the Second World War in the resistance, as were my father's family in the Netherlands. So I think, you know, epigenetically, I've kind of taken on this notion that it's okay to resist because, you know, and if you look historically, there is always this kind of change in, you know, between humans want freedoms, but we never get them without fighting for them. So, you know, as systems
or as was once said by a famous luminary, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a great aphorism.
Exactly. Leonardo da Vinci, he said, nothing strengthens authority so much as silence. You know, so, we cannot afford to be silent. Indira Gandhi, you know, this is the daughter of Nehru, the first prime minister of India, she said the power to question is the basis of all human progress. And these are the very things now that are under threat if we don't sort out this digital town square. And you know, we're not talking about allowing hate speech. We're not talking about allowing information about terrorism. We're talking about just reasonable, uncertain, you know, information around health so that people can use these
If you're publishing information about how to assemble a pipe bomb, you know, perhaps that's something that we ought to throttle down. But, you know, so our call to action today, and, you know, let me just summarize because we're going to continue our discussion because there's more issues I want to broach with you in part two. I just want to mention that we're conducting a campaign. Rob Verkerk, as executive director, and I as president of the Alliance for Natural Health, ANH-USA.org, we have an action alert about our Freedom of Choice campaign, Free Speech for Health campaign. You can find out about it at ANH-USA.org. And we're also trying to raise money for this cause. So let me just say that if you have been the beneficiary of some of the health information here on Intelligent Medicine, or in general, you know, if you are someone who's experienced the benefits of diet, the benefits of supplements, the benefits of herbs, the benefits of homeopathy, the benefits of, you know, a profession of, say, naturopathic medicine or functional medicine, please take the time to make, you know, a small contribution according to your means to the ANH. Go to drhoffman.com/ANH. That's drhoffman.com/ANH. And we're conducting campaigns. It's a matching campaign. I'll be matching all donations up to a total of $5,000. So let's achieve that goal by a week's end. And let's continue in part two because we have some, you know, let's talk some specifics about the campaign against disinformation, misinformation, how insidious it is and how it threatens our rights as citizens. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest today is Rob Verkerk, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.